Blowing in the wind. As soon as Old Chun got home, he took a couple of aspirins, went to bed and slept until morning. When he woke up, he still didn't feel like getting up. At midday, he made some instant noodles, one of the 100 flavors offered by the Master Kong brand, but he didn't care which flavor he was eating. When he'd finished, he went on to the Dangdang and Amazon China internet sites to look up Yang Jiang's works. It was true. There really were no entries under her name. He went on to look up 4th of June 1989 and Falun Gong 1999, and just as he expected, no books on these topics came up. But then he found that there were no books listed either about the Yan'an rectification campaign, land reform, the 1979 Democracy Wall movement, the April 5th movement, and the 1983 anti-spiritual pollution and crackdown on crime campaign. No books on any of these previously frequently discussed topics of the 1980s and 1990s. The only books that kept coming up were The China Reader, Contemporary China, and The Popular Edition of A Short History of China, two standard tomes on modern and contemporary Chinese history, both authorized by the government in the last 2 years. Old Feng really could be extremely perceptive, and this time he was right on target. In all the bookstores and even on their websites, where they claim to stock every book in the world, of all the thousands of titles listed, Old Chun could not find one single book that might explain the true facts about contemporary Chinese history. Why hadn't he noticed this a long time ago? During the Cultural Revolution and at the beginning of reforms and openness, there were very few books in the bookstores, and everyone knew that the true facts were being suppressed. But today, thought Old Chun, there is a profusion of books everywhere. So many they knock you over. But the true facts are still being suppressed. It's just that people are under the illusion that they are following their own reading preferences and freely choosing what they read. Continuing his web search, he discovered he couldn't find anything by using key phrases like 4th of June 1989, Tiananmen Incident, and so on. Even the items that came up on the Cultural Revolution were terrible. Just a load of nostalgic guff for an adolescence spent in the brilliant sunshine of the glorious past. The few items that discussed the history of the Cultural Revolution were only simplistic, officially sanitized versions. Old Chun was aghast. No wonder young people today cannot even say who belonged to the Gang of Four, he thought, and people born after 1980 have never even heard of Wei Jingsheng, the early dissident who called for democracy as the fifth modernization, or Liu Bingyang, the most celebrated People's Daily investigative reporter of the 1980s. And no wonder, whenever the June 1989 student leader Wang Dang lectures overseas about the Tiananmen massacre, there are always Chinese overseas students in the audience who jeer at him. Today's younger generation has no way of knowing. What a tremendous generation gap in knowledge of contemporary Chinese history there is. For people in their 50s and 60s, these important events are part of their general knowledge. When they get together now, they still talk about them, and they even have several books and periodicals about those times that are no longer available. Because they share this knowledge, They really haven't noticed how they've become increasingly marginalized. They ceased representing the mass of society long ago. There is no longer any channel for them to pass their understanding on to the younger generation. Old Chun reflected on Lu Sheng's counterfeit paradise and good hell. In a good hell, people are aware that they're living in hell and so they want to transform it. But after living for a long time in a fake paradise, people become accustomed to it and they actually believe that they're already in paradise. All this was quite obvious to him. Old Chun himself was a living example, he had to concede. In the last couple of years, he'd had no stomach for reading about China's painful contemporary history. All he'd wanted to read were famous Chinese classics and romantic fiction. He hadn't realized that history had been rewritten and the true facts had been airbrushed away. Old Chun was a writer of fiction, someone who told stories. He also knew that reality could be regarded merely as a construction, and that history was subject to different interpretations. Truth itself could be a field of contested knowledge. Nevertheless, when it came to lying with one's eyes wide open, squinting to deliberately alter reality, distorting the true facts of history without the least scruple, and nakedly falsifying the records, Old Chun had to feel at least a twinge of uneasiness. But it was only a twinge. If Old Chun had not been a reporter, he probably wouldn't have felt any need to respect historical reality. Most people don't care much about the truth, he pondered. There is, in fact, no way for the average person to care about these things. The price of maintaining a firm commitment to truth is too great. Besides that, the true facts are often painful to recall, and who doesn't prefer pleasure to pain? At this point, Old Chun wanted to lay down the heavy burden of history. Can we really blame the common people for their historical amnesia, he asked himself? Should we force the younger generation to remember the suffering of their parents' generation? Do our intellectuals have a duty to walk through a minefield in order to oppose the machine of state? Who has the leisure time to mess around looking up these few historical facts? And furthermore, it's not that all eyewitness accounts and historical memoirs have been banned. There are plenty of books still available. Only those books that contradict the Chinese Communist Party's orthodox historical discourse are totally banned. Old Chun then considered a new concept. 90% freedom. We're already very free now. 90% or even more of all subjects can be freely discussed. And 90% or even more of all activities are no longer subject to government control. Isn't that enough? The vast majority of the population cannot even handle 90% freedom. They think it's too much. Aren't they already complaining about information overload and being entertained to death? The more he thought about it, the more Old Chun felt he was right. He had a very long list of unread books that he wanted to read, including Chinese classical studies, such as the 24 official histories, and classic European fiction, such as the 19th century Russian novels. He regarded these as the high point of Western fiction, but because the reading priorities of Taiwan and mainland China had been different back then, while mainland intellectuals of his generation read the fiction of Imperial Russia, Old Chun read American fiction. Old Chun felt somewhat guilty about being a writer of fiction without having read the great Russian novels. He'd always told himself that one day he would make up for this literary lacuna. Now old age is approaching, so what am I waiting for? It's enough for me to have these classics. I don't need too much freedom. And furthermore, when the national situation permits, the state can always relax its restrictions and permit up to 95% freedom. Maybe we already have 95%. That would be very little less than in the West. Western nations also have some restrictions on freedom of speech and action. The German government restricts neo-Nazi organizations, and many states in the United States deny homosexuals the freedom to marry. The only disparity is that theoretically, the power of Western governments is given to them by the people, while in China, the people's freedom is given to them by the government. Is this distinction really that important? Now, even his cleaning lady tells him, things are much better today than they were before. It's all that bloody Fang Chaudi's fault, grumbled Old Chen. With his nonsense about a missing month and Yang Jiang's books being unavailable, he's messed with my mind. Now, Old Chen had only two worries, both of his own making. What to write about in his next novel, and how to find his long-delayed love. He phoned his friend, Hu Yang, from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. Hu Yang had also come to understand that she should stay at home and rest at the weekend and not go to work. She was reaching late middle age, her children were all in university, and she didn't need to work so hard, or so her husband had been telling her for some time. She also knew that she could never expect to finish all her projects. Things were very different for her now. In the past, her research projects had not been considered important. She couldn't find funding, and the projects often got her into trouble. But now she could be considered as a leader in her field, and research on rural society and culture had become an important field of study. She remembered that in the early 1990s, when she'd been investigating in southeast Guizhou how the girls of minority peoples were unable to attend school, she had had to rely on money donated from Taiwan and Hong Kong to fund the project. In the mid-1990s, when she'd studied the lack of access to schools for the children of peasant workers in urban areas, Beijing academic circles had deprecated such projects, and various levels of government had resisted and even tried to suppress her investigations. It was not until 2000 that things took a 180-degree turn, when the central government announced its new rural policies. Local administrators all had to develop corresponding policies, and so they sought out many academic specialists for consultation. Hu Yang received large government grants to investigate construction and the circulation of goods and capital in rural areas, grants large enough to make many of her colleagues jealous. In more recent years, while conducting field research, Hu Yang had become aware of an interesting phenomenon, the very rapid growth of Protestant churches. According to the figures in a 2008 survey, the combined number of adherents to the Protestant underground churches, to the government-sanctioned Protestant Three Self-Patriotic Church, and to the Catholic Patriotic Church was 50 million. But in Hu Yang's mind, the figure should have been 100 million. This 100% increase had all taken place in the last 2 years. But Hu Yang was concerned that she already had so many big projects in hand, more than she could handle. She wondered whether it would be worth the trouble to study rural, informal churches. Especially because the sociology of religion was not her speciality, and if she successfully set up a project and obtained government funding, even more people would be green-eyed with jealousy. The gossip and innuendo bruited around would be pretty nasty. Accusations of academic hegemony or intellectual imperialism would be the most polite of the lot. Hu Yang had always maintained a good reputation and had never provoked any academic gossip, and so she had to seriously consider the consequences of pursuing her research on the underground church movement. The temptation was too great, though. Out of China's 1.3 billion people, 100 million were Christians, one out of every 13. The government could not but consider them important. Hu Yang knew the underground church movement was soon to become an extremely hot social topic. How could she stand not to forge ahead with such research? Recently, she'd been feeling a rush of excitement that lingered all day long. Late one Sunday afternoon, while her husband was in the kitchen cooking dinner and singing revolutionary songs, Hu Yang was in her study trying to figure out how to launch this research. Just then, she received a call from Old Chen. He needed her input on something. They arranged to meet for lunch at the Sichuan restaurant next to the academy. The following day, Old Chen took Fang Chaudi with him to see Hu Yang, explaining that if he wanted to know the real situation in China, he could do no better than ask Hu Yang. Nobody knows more about the lower strata of society than she does, he told him. If Hu Yang says she has not heard of something, then that something does not exist.
When I remember something, Fang Chaudi said peevishly, no matter what anybody says, I won't forget it.
Old Chen also had another important reason for seeing Hu Yang. A few days earlier, She'd sent him an email with a report about research on Chinese Christian underground churches, and he wanted to ask her what she thought about Mai Zi Bu Si, the grain does not die. Over lunch, Hu Yang explained what she was working on, helping the government draft policies for the administration of agricultural cooperatives and rural financial institutions, and investigating the social effects of the circulation of goods and capital in rural areas. If you sum it up simply, Ou Chen asked, looking for a straight answer, is the situation in the countryside getting better or worse? Well, of course, there are still problems, answered Hu Yang, but overall, we've entered a period of positive feedback. Having asked for and received this conclusive answer, Ou Chen was perfectly satisfied and content. He'd visited several cities in China, and he knew that first, second, and third level cities were all extremely prosperous. Even county level cities were all developing very nicely. The urban people were living well, and the government's goal of a moderately good standard of living had been easily achieved. What Ou Chen was not so sure about was the rural situation. He'd only visited villages near major cities and had never lived in the proper countryside for any length of time. Every so often, he would phone Hu Yang and ask her if the rural situation was getting better or worse, as if he were making a long-distance call home and gaining peace of mind on hearing that things were indeed improving. Securing the knowledge that the rural situation was now better, Ou Chen told himself that on the whole, China was constantly improving, and so he could go on living his good life with a clear conscience. As far as asking for the details of the positive feedback Hu Yang had mentioned, Ou Chen didn't need information overload. He would leave that to the experts. Professor Hu, Fang Chaodi asked, interrupting Ou Chen's musings, what do you think about the time between when the world economy entered a new period of crisis and China's golden age of ascendancy officially began? Hu Yang looked like she didn't quite understand what Fang Chaodi was saying. I mean that month in between, Fang went on. 28 days, to be precise. The front page of the People's Daily reported, Hu Yang said very patiently, that the world economy entered a period of crisis and China's golden age of ascendancy officially began on the same day. That was the day the American dollar lost one-third of its value in one go, and the Chinese government announced its new prosperity policy, or NPP. Everybody knows this. I don't know, Mr. Fang, how you arrive at this 28-day figure. Fang Xiaodi was silent, and Ou Chen thought to himself, Old Fang, this time there is nothing you can say. Ou Chen asked about the report Hu Yang had written on her research on the Christian underground church movement. We recommended, Hu Yang said, that the central government desensitize the question of religion, that is, abandon their sensitivity to religion. We advise the government not to treat it as a question of the enemy versus us, or not even as a contradiction among the people. They should normalize the question of religion. That is, they should regard religion as a normal part of life. We should learn a lesson from previous policy and not make another mistake like the 1999 suppression of the Falun Gong. They absolutely should not, Fang Chaodi chimed in. They absolutely should not make that same mistake. It would be too evil. Hu Yang nodded her agreement. Hu Yang, Ou Chen finally came to his main question. What do you think about the words, Mai Zi Bu Si, the grain does not die? I'm not too familiar with the Christian Bible, said Hu Yang, but I think this statement is from the Gospels. Something like, the grain that falls upon the ground does not die? All Christians are aware of this passage. There is an underground church in Henan province that is called the Lao Di Mai Zi, the church of the grain fallen on the ground. Where in Henan? Ou Chen asked quickly. In West or North Henan, said Hu Yan. I can ask one of my colleagues for the exact location. Find that out for me, will you? Asked Ou Chen. No problem. After they'd parted from Hu Yan, Fang Chaodi said, Professor Hu is a good person, but she is not one of us. Thank God, said Ou Chen, that there are still people in the world who are not like you. I could tell from her expression, Fang Chaodi said. She was so happy, and as I expected, she didn't know about that lost month. Fang Chaodi, Old Chen urged him. Forget all about that so-called lost month. It's not worth it. Life's too short. Just look after yourself. Fang Chaodi didn't answer. Old Chen knew that no matter how clever he was, he could never change Fang Chaodi. Once they were sitting in the car, Fang Chaodi said, Old Chen, do me the honour of coming to Miao Miao's house to have dinner with Zhang Du, Miao Miao and me, okay? Old Chen didn't much want to go there, but since he might need his help to find little C, and he didn't have anything else to do, he agreed. His acceptance pleased Fang Chaodi. This whole area, he said, pointing to Chang'an Boulevard as he started the car, used to be full of out-of-town petitioners coming to state their grievances to the government. I once went over there specially to see if I could find any people like me among that big crowd. What do you think happened? There isn't even a single petitioner anymore, and the shacks they used to live in on the south side have all been demolished. At first, I was thinking maybe that friend of yours was hiding there. It had been years since Old Chen had given any thought to all those out-of-town petitioners, but he was sure of one thing. Even if there were still petitioners there, little C would not be one of them. That area was close to the prosecutor's office and the law courts, and little C would stay far away so as not to be seen by anyone who knew her. Fang Chaodi continued rattling on about everything under the sun while Old Chen more or less ignored him. In fact, he would not have agreed to dinner if he'd known Fang lived so far out of Beijing. When they arrived at Miao Miao's house in Huairou, Fang Chaodi introduced him to Zhang Du, Miao Miao and their pack of dogs and cats. Then he took Old Chen into the living room. The four walls were lined with metal shelves on which were piled newspaper clippings, magazines and other miscellaneous junk. In the middle was a desk, a folding chair and a camp bed. Old Chen, Fang Chaodi pointed to the newspapers and magazines, these things are all the evidence I've collected for over 2 years. They prove what really happened during those 28 days. You're an intellectual. You've spent your whole life seeking truth and beauty. You've struggled to uphold what is true. You ought to be able to understand all the work I've done on this. Take a good look at it while I fix our candlelit dinner. Old Chen was left standing by himself, grudgingly, in the room. Miao Miao came in and put a plate of chocolate cookies on top of the desk for him and then abruptly left. Old Chen was feeling bored. He popped a cookie into his mouth and picked up a few out-of-date periodicals and a couple of small local newspapers which he flipped through at random. He really couldn't see how Fang Chaodi could discern the true facts of history in them. He went on to look at odd half-pages from editions of the Southern Weekly, Southern Metropolis Daily and China Youth Daily, and incomplete issues of the Caijing Magazine, Southern Window and Asia Weekly. Old Chen recalled that everything had been calm in Beijing during that period. There had been no big disturbances. If there had been even one, it would have left some impression on him. From the so-called evidence that Fang Chaodi had collected, it would seem that there had been some sort of unrest in other areas of the country, but that was nothing unusual. China is so big that it's not unusual for there to be some kind of turmoil somewhere every day, he thought. He never looked for that kind of news, and even if it did catch his eye, he would just skip over it. China is such a big country. There are so many things one doesn't know about. It's like a blind man examining an elephant. How could he ever know its real shape? An epistemological impossibility. These little bits and pieces of evidence collected by Fang Chaodi don't explain anything. In fact, to say that one whole month has gone missing isn't strictly accurate. It's just that people's recollections of that month are different, he insisted to himself. Furthermore, if you deliberately looked for bad things happening in China, you could find plenty of examples. If you only looked for good things, you'd find a whole panorama of them. Big countries are all like that. Look at the United States or India. What's so unusual about China? The most important thing today is that the world economy has fallen into a period of crisis everywhere, except for in China. Little C, where are you? I hope you can put the past to rest and return to the good life of the present. If you want to live with me, then we can live well together. Perhaps it was due to the chocolate cookies, but Old Chun began to feel better, and he became even more firmly resolved to locate Little C. As the early spring evening fell, the atmosphere of their outdoor candlelit dinner was very conducive to happiness. Feng Chaodi cooked dish after dish and piled them on the table. He invited Old Chun to taste them first and asked Zhang Du to play his Spanish guitar for atmosphere. Nearby in the yard, Miao Miao began dancing with her dogs and cats. Old Chun had a few mouthfuls and thought each dish tasted pretty good. "What part of China are these dishes from?" he asked Feng Chaodi.
"Chop suey vegetables," said Old Feng. "Look closely. I'm using Sichuan peppers, Hunan black bean sauce, Guangdong shrimp paste, Thai lemongrass, and our own coriander, sweet basil, lemon leaf and leeks. They're all organic. We just pick 'em and eat 'em. And we fertilize 'em with our own and the cats and dogs' poo."
Conversation over dinner was pleasant, and what was most surprising to Old Chun was when Feng Chaodi told him why he admired him so much. Old Chun had always thought that it was because his literary style impressed Old Feng. But Feng Chaodi said it was because of something Old Chun had once said, though he couldn't remember it. In 1989, when Feng Chaodi allowed himself to be interviewed, he insisted that he was genuinely clairvoyant. When he'd seen the military blockade on the road to the Summer Palace in 1971, he'd known the Mao Zedong Ling Biao incident had happened. When he'd looked out of the window of Hong Kong's Chongqing Mansions onto Nathan Road and seen a man jump to his death across the street, he'd known that something was about to go wrong in Hong Kong. And sure enough, the Hang Seng Index collapsed from 1,700 points to only slightly over 100. In that American commune in 1975, when his hippie friends were beating on pots and pans to celebrate the end of the Vietnam War, he'd had a vision of refugees swarming out of Vietnam, and of course, his vision became reality. As he went on talking and talking, Old Chun had interrupted him and asked, "What's the significance of these premonitions? Did they change anything later?"
"Old Chun," said Feng Chaodi, "with that one question you woke me up from my dreams. When I thought about it, my powers of premonition that I thought made me different from other people never had the slightest influence on the world and never even changed my own fate. They really didn't have any significance at all." From that time on, Feng Chaodi no longer considered his premonitions to be of any importance and no longer put himself under any pointless pressure. This was all due to that one question of Old Chun's. From that, he knew that Old Chun was an extraordinarily talented person.
"Little brother," Feng Chaodi instructed Zhang Du, "Old Chun is far wiser than we are. We should listen to him, you understand?"
When Old Chun, who was eating with great gusto, heard Feng Chaodi say this, he felt a little embarrassed. He stood up to give Old Feng a hug. Old Chun found he was enjoying the flavours of their long dinner very much, so much so, in fact, that some of his lost feeling of happiness started to come back. He felt so good that he actually found himself telling his two companions how he'd come to know the insomniac national leader, He Dongsheng. He explained how He Dongsheng would sleep through the films Jiang Ling showed, but could not sleep at night, and so drove his own car all over town. And when he was pulled over by a traffic cop, he phoned his secretary, who then wiped his ass for him. After dinner, Zhang Du carried on playing his guitar, and Feng Chaodi sang Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind. Old Feng sang it perfectly in the style of the young Dylan. As they continued drinking Yangjing beer and eating cookies, Zhang Du took out his computer and went on the internet. Feng Chaodi asked Old Chun to show him how to look up his friend. "I'm not exactly sure," said Old Chun. "I only have this note." He took it out of his pocket.
"What does it mean?" asked Feng Chaodi.
"I think it's Mai Zi Bu Si, the grain does not die, in Romanized script," said Old Chun. Zhang Du took a look.
"Let's go to Henan and look for her," said Feng Chaodi. "I'll drive. Professor Hu said that church is in Henan. We can find out where exactly when we get there."
"Whoa! Don't get too excited," said Old Chun. "That church is called the Church of the Grain Fallen on the Ground, but I don't even know for certain that Little C is called Mai Zi Bu Si.
not to mention whether or not the two names are related.
I found Mai Zibusi, exclaimed Zhang Du suddenly.
Old Chen and Fang Chaodi gathered around the computer.
You just put in Mai Zibusi? Asked Old Chen.
Zhang Du nodded. Old Chen had only guessed at Chinese characters for Mai Zibusi and had never thought to just look up the Romanized text. There was only one link, a post put up 2 weeks before on the club3.kdnet.net Cat's Eye server.
Idiot numbskill, you say you are so broken-hearted you'll never post another message. Well, I'm pretty broken-hearted too, but I understand. All your thoughtful articles are willfully deleted by the internet police and maliciously attacked by a gang of angry youth thugs. Those people in their 50s and 60s who act like thugs when they go on the internet. You never use malicious language, and you always present the facts and make reasonable arguments. So I greatly admire your firm resolve. It encourages me to keep on going. I'm not afraid of the angry youth, and I'm even less afraid of those aging hoodlums. I will persevere to the end, because I believe that human beings are rational and that the truth cannot be suppressed forever. Goodbye for now, friend. We'll meet again in this virtual world. Mai Zibusi.
Is that her? Asked Fang Chaodi. Certainly sounds like her, said Old Chen.
From her tone, she's one of us,
Fang said.
From the tone, the writer's not young either, said Zhang Du.
Where was it sent from?
Fang Chaodi asked Zhang Du.
I don't know. I'll have to ask someone online to help me find out.
When Old Chen saw that it might be Little C, he was so overcome with emotion that he had to sit down and hold back his tears.
Let me tell you about those 28 days, said Fang Chaodi
as he handed Old Chen another bottle of beer and sat down in front of him. He took a few deep breaths like an athlete warming up before a race.
That year, just before the Spring Festival, I took a trip to Macau. And on the way back, I stayed in Zhongshan in Guangdong for a change of scene. Zhongshan was once a very prosperous area, but people from Hong Kong and Macau were no longer coming to buy houses or holiday there. The factories had shut down, the peasant workers had to stay in the countryside rather than return to work in the city, and university graduates could not get jobs. I'd been cooking for a baked squab restaurant for only a few days when I was let go. I didn't care. I could just enjoy myself. On the eighth day of the first lunar month, I noticed that the Southern Daily and all the other papers at a newsstand had the exact same headline. World economy entering period of crisis. Everybody was feeling worried. The atmosphere became extremely tense and my landlady came looking for me.
Did you register at the police station before you moved in? She asked.
What kind of age are we living in? I asked. Do outsiders have to register to live in Zhongshan?
She retorted that if I didn't register, I couldn't stay. And I said she was violating our contract. At this point, the neighbours came over. The local authorities had told them to. They actually said that my landlady could pay for me to stay in a small inn, but I could no longer stay in their courtyard, and they made me hand over my room key immediately. I asked for my deposit back and told them I'd move out.
What point are you trying to make? Asked Old Chen, growing impatient.
Paranoia, said Fang Chaodi. It was like that for at least a week. Everybody said China was going to fall into chaos. The machinery of the state was nowhere to be seen. The situation was approaching anarchy. It was lucky the peasant workers had not come back to the city, or there would have been serious trouble. But I should never have left Zhongshan. If a city like Zhongshan was that tightly wound up, I should have known that the further inland I went, the worse it would be. As I made my way over the hills, I felt like a mouse crossing a busy street, and I acted quite recklessly. I still wanted to go sightseeing, to visit Jinggangshan, Mao Zedong's revolutionary base in Jiangxi, as well as Mount Longhu. When I passed Shaoguan and came to the outskirts of a town called Meishan Fork, where the three provinces of Guangdong, Hunan and Jiangxi meet, the bus was stopped and everybody had to get off. Outsiders were not allowed to enter the town. We were not stopped by police, but by a temporary detachment of townspeople.
I slipped away and stayed in a peasant's house until 2 days later when I was picked up by the public security police. The peasant had turned me in because the People's Liberation Army had already begun a general crackdown. Then they discovered, Fang went on, that I was carrying an American passport. It wasn't that I didn't want to be Chinese when I came back from the US, but it's a hell of a lot harder to regain Chinese citizenship than it is for a Chinese to become an American citizen. So I registered myself in Beijing as a corporation and hired myself as a manager. I renewed my contract regularly, and so I had a work permit. Once in a while, I went to Hong Kong or Macau, but I could return and live indefinitely in China. Back to my being arrested. There was a 6-person joint hearing in an office of that public security bureau. There were 2 public security police, 2 prosecutors, and 2 judges. One of the prosecutors was a formidable older woman, and one of the judges was a very young woman. "Look at you," said the female prosecutor. "You don't look like an American. Say something in English for us." I recited a section of Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind, and I did it quite fluently. But the prosecutor was having none of it. "You're obviously Chinese. You can't fool anybody by pretending to be American. Why would an American hide in a peasant's house? What the hell is an American doing here anyway? There aren't any tourist attractions or investment opportunities here. You look like an American spy to me."
"Captured foreign spies are to be executed," said the male prosecutor.
"You have no objections?" female prosecutor asked, looking at the young female judge. "He can't be executed," said the young female judge.
"Why not?" asked the male prosecutor. "We're supposed to punish criminals severely and rapidly."
"If we capture an American spy," the young judge said, "we're supposed to report it to the higher authorities." The 2 prosecutors immediately responded that that would take too much time.
"Then let's pass sentence," said the male prosecutor.
"You can't pass sentence," said the young female judge.
"Why can't we pass sentence?" asked the male prosecutor. "The Americans sent a spy over here and we Chinese are not happy. Isn't that so?"
"You can be unhappy," the young female judge countered, "but you can't be stupid. If he's a spy, we have to report it to the higher authorities. If he isn't, we have to let him go."
"Americans no longer have extraterritorial rights," said the male prosecutor.
"It has nothing to do with extraterritoriality," said the female judge. "It is not a crime for a Chinese person to carry an American passport in China, and that's according to our own Chinese law."
The 2 prosecutors looked very unsettled at what the young judge was saying. "Comrade," the female prosecutor said, "stop arguing. You know perfectly well you're wasting police time. They worked so hard to arrest this guy, and now you want to let him go. This is a waste of our group's time too, and furthermore, you're interfering with our work schedule. At this rate, we won't be able to reach the target set by the higher authorities." The other prosecutor nodded his head in approval while the 2 public security officials and the other judge had yet to open their mouths.
"I can't worry about that," said the stubborn young female judge. "I operate on the basis of our national laws. If he's a spy, report him to the higher authorities. If he's not a spy, set him free."
The female prosecutor stared fiercely at the young judge. She was so angry she was about to explode, but the men just bowed their heads in silence. I was stunned. Then the female prosecutor shouted, "Get him out of here!" And they escorted me off the premises.
My life and freedom had been saved. Even in a deserted little town like that, China has outstanding talent like that young woman. Even if it's just for her sake, I cannot allow the world to forget what happened during that lost month. Old Chen was moved by Fang's story and longed even more for little Xi.
"I knew," Fang Chaodi continued, "I couldn't keep running around wildly. If I was picked up again, I might really be executed." There was a Taoist temple near the town, and when I recited the names of a few old Taoist monks I'd heard of, the old monk there let me stay. "Some other time, I'll tell you about my monastic seclusion and the practice of inedia. You've heard of inedia, haven't you? It basically amounts to fasting. Would you believe I can practice inedia for 14 days? We could have a competition and see who can practice it for the longest time."
"Forget it," said old Chen, looking at a text message. "You win already. I can't stand missing a single meal." Finish your story. I need to talk to you about something.
I wanted to practice in Edia, in the temple, for 21 days, Fang went on. But when I reached the 14th day, the old monk came in with a bowl of gruel and told me that I should go outside and see what was happening in the world. What he said made sense, so I went back to the county seat, where the atmosphere was still extremely tense, and the papers announced that there was no end in sight to the crackdown. Fortunately, transport was running again, and so I went to Jiangzhou in Jiangxi. It was eerily quiet. People were avoiding each other's eyes in the street, just like in Beijing after 4th of June 1989. At the beginning of March, evening papers announced that the crackdown had come to an end, and the following day all the papers carried the same headline: China's golden age of prosperity has officially begun. Now, everyone was smiling and taking to the streets to set off firecrackers. So you see, there were 28 days between the time the world economy entered a period of crisis and China's golden age of ascendancy was officially announced. The nation went from potential anarchy and terror to the comparatively lesser fear of a police crackdown. China's age of ascendancy was not announced until after the crackdown, and not, as everyone today says, on the same day that the world economy went into crisis. That's the end of my story, Old Chen. Now, what did you want to talk to me about? I've had a text message from Hu Yang. She says the grain fallen on the ground underground church is in Jiazhou in Henan. Oh, Fang, let's take a trip to Henan. Chapter 5. The Faith, Hope and Love of Several People. The grain fallen on the ground does not die. Fang Chaodi had been all over, north and south of the Yangtze, and as he drove his Jeep Cherokee at high speed along the G4 highway, overtaking every car he came to, he told Old Chen about some of the strange and fascinating things he had witnessed. Fang Chaodi said there was a place called Happy Village in the Mount Taihang area of Hebei. Everyone in the village was exceptionally happy, but the media had been repeatedly ordered not to report this, probably because upstream from the village was a huge secret chemical factory. After he'd heard about it from a reporter in the provincial capital, Shi Juajuan, Fang Chaodi went directly to Happy Village. Everyone in the village really was smiling and extraordinarily friendly. They all looked pretty healthy too. The men wore flowers in their hair, and there were old women sitting around, bare to the waist and sunning their droopy breasts. They didn't seem to mind at all when strangers walked by. It was a spectacle virtually never seen in China. He followed the river upstream from the village, and after about 5 kilometers, he saw a huge chemical factory with a wide perimeter barbed wire fence and warning signs all around it. There was no way to get any closer, but he could see small planes flying in and out of what looked like a private landing strip. Old Chen listened to Fang Chaodi. He didn't dare say a word, even though he felt like it, for fear that Fang Chaodi would take his attention off the road. He was driving so fast and talking so much that several times they came very close to an oncoming vehicle. Old Chen vowed that if he arrived in Henan alive, he'd give thanks to God and Buddha. Old Chen didn't want to die this way before he had found Little C. If he were to die in an accident, he hoped it would be while holding her hand and facing their last seconds of life together. If he were to die a natural death, he hoped that Little C would be sitting at his bedside watching over him. He wanted to grow old with her, but now she was almost definitely living in her own personal hell, unable to see any way out. He had to give her hope, had to end her loneliness, had to do everything in his power to bring her out of her shell, so that she wouldn't feel so exhausted. Old Chen took out his handkerchief and, pretending to clean his glasses, stealthily dabbed at his moistening eyes. He took a bite of one of Miao Miao's cookies. Outside the window was the unending North China Plain, and inside his heart was full of unending love. He never imagined he could feel this way at his age. Driving south from Beijing past Baoding, but before they reached Shijiazhuang, Fang Chaodi pulled over to the side of the highway near a slip road.
Follow the highway from Shijiazhuang and we'll be there, said Old Chun, looking at the GPS. Feng Chaodi didn't respond. What's wrong? Asked Old Chun.
I'm sorry, said Feng Chaodi, but I'm having a premonition.
Premonition about what? Old Chun asked, fearing that it was about little C.
A premonition,
Feng said, about that happy village I told you about. What about it? Old Chun was outwardly relieved it was nothing to do with little C.
I don't know, Feng said, but I'd like to take a look. It won't take long, it's not very far.
Old Chun could only agree with him. They turned off on the side road and headed west on a paved road for about half an hour, and then went into the hills for about 20 minutes on a gravel road. They got out of the car and walked another half an hour on a mountain road until they reached Happy Village. It was completely deserted. Feng Chaodi went into each house one by one.
The villagers didn't even take their farm tools or kitchen utensils, he said. It looks pretty suspicious.
Old Chun was interested in something else. He noticed all the houses in Happy Village were the typically simple and crude constructions you see in rural North China, especially in Hebei. The peasants of Hebei were not the poorest in China, but Old Chun believed that of all the rural architecture in China, that of Hebei was the most unsightly. They made no stylistic demands, and generation after generation they continued to build crude and simple houses. It was easy to see that the peasants of Hebei didn't care much about aesthetics. Although they were simple, there were coloured paintings on the outside walls of every house. The paintings had the flavour of those New Year pictures called Nianhua, but their style was much freer, and some of them even exhibited some charmingly sexual poses. In Old Chun's present state of mind, he could see feelings of love in the paintings. On one wall was a very colourful, life-sized flower. This kind of extra decoration and attempted adornment was something rarely seen in a primitive Hebei village. These peasants had become graffiti artists, and perhaps Happy Village really lived up to its name. Old Chun thought it would be interesting to meet the peasants who had made the paintings, but some other time. What's wrong? He asked Feng Chaodi, who was staring blankly upstream. Let's go.
It's been less than a year, said Feng, and they've all gone.
Don't ask me to walk another 5 kilometres upstream, said Old Chun. I can't even walk 1 more kilometre.
There must be a road, said Feng Chaodi, that leads to the chemical factory.
That road probably comes from the Shaanxi side, said Old Chun, trying to dissuade Feng Chaodi from the trip to the factory he knew he was about to suggest. I can think of 100 reasons why the villagers moved, and none of them have anything to do with that factory. You shouldn't always be trying to find some sort of conspiracy. Feng Chaodi stubbornly refused to move, so Old Chun played his trump card.
Old Feng, he said,
you know that your premonition can't prevent something from actually happening.
Yes, you're right, said Feng Chaodi. Let's go.
Wei Xihong, female from Beijing, also known as Little C. Most recent internet name, Mai Zibusu. Last known employment, selling ice cream bars in the Yellow Emperor's hometown of Xinjun in Henan province. Previously employed as a ticket seller in 3 villages, claiming to be the original home of the mythical Pangyu. Looking at this itinerary, her next stop would be either Mount Shennong, named for the legendary founder of agriculture, or one of the various places that claim to be where the great Yu parted the waters and created the Chinese continent. Indeed, she next went to Jiaozuo, known in ancient times as Kuaichuan. There are 6 old cities in this region, and local legend has it that nearby is the place where Emperor Yangdi, or Shennong, planted the 5 grains and tasted the 100 grasses. It goes without saying that there are many parks with historical themes in the area, and no shortage of jobs in the tourist trade. She didn't, however, immediately look for employment, but wandered around somewhat distractedly because Jiaozuo brought back some deeply personal memories. She thought of her first posting as a judicial clerk secretary in that county-level court, and of the pressures on her to agree to all those executions. The examples her colleagues brought up to sway her were of Zheng Zhou, Kaifeng, and Luoyang, all of which towns had executed 40 or 50 people. Even a backwater like Jiazhou had executed 30 people. When Little Xi visited Luoyang, Kaifeng and Jiangzhou, the events of the 1983 crackdown never entered her head. But when she went to Jiazhou, the events of that year appeared right before her eyes. Those events had changed her life forever and proved she was not cut out to be a judge in the People's Republic of China. Little Xi stayed in bed for 2 days in a small inn in Jiazhou before coming to a decision. She resolved to rid herself of the ghosts of the 1983 crackdown. In the early morning of the third day, she took a small bus towards Wen County, Jiazhou, and went to the Warm Springs Township. She walked around aimlessly until she passed a big house where the front gate was open and a number of friendly-looking, elegant people were milling around in the yard. There was a spring couplet pasted on the gate. The top line read, "Heaven bestows the tree of life. Faith, hope, and love abide eternally." The bottom line read, "The spring of life gushes from the earth. Body, mind, and soul dedicated completely." "Is this a home church?" wondered Little C. "Aren't they supposed to be underground? How can they be so open?" At that point, the people in the yard disappeared into the building, leaving only one middle-aged man standing by the gate looking at Little Xi. He took a few steps towards her, and she saw that he was lame. "Please, come in," he said to her. Little Xi walked slowly into the yard with her eyes fixed on the banner on the house front. "Grain fallen on the ground does not die." She thought to herself, "I've only ever heard that the spirit does not die, or that matter cannot be destroyed. But this says that the grain of wheat never dies. It certainly accords with philosophical materialism." The man responsible for the Church of the Grain Fallen on the Ground was called Gao Shengchang. From his name, meaning high level of production, one could easily tell that his parents had been minor local officials who had given their children names like production and planning in accordance with government policies at the time of their births. 2 years earlier, Gao Shengchang, Li Tiezhen and three others had organized an underground Protestant church in Jiazhou City, but they soon came into conflict with a government-run Three Self Patriotic Church, were arrested by the public security police on orders from the local Bureau of Religion and were sent to prison. There they dubbed themselves Grain Fallen on the Ground, from Jesus' parable that if only one grain of wheat fell on the ground and died, it would then give birth to a great deal more wheat. They'd already resolved to die for their religion, and they grew even stronger in prison. They would never abandon God's work. After their release, they were all the more resolute. Li Tiezhen, who had made some money in business, bought a piece of land in the Warm Springs Township, built a big meeting house, and established a Christian fellowship. Four leaders set up fellowships in the villages around Jiazhou and put into practice Mao Zedong's policy of the countryside surrounding the city. Gao Shengchang travelled between these four fellowships preaching the gospel. Nowadays, the Bureau of Religion and the Public Security Police no longer bothered them as before. Even more unusual was that almost more people than the fellowship could handle were asking to join their church. More than 30 people now participated in the Warm Springs Fellowship's daily witness meetings and Bible study sessions, and there were upwards of 200 people at their weekend revival meetings. The parishioners introduced new members every day, and some, like Little C, just walked in off the street. Gao Shengchang had once worried that if the church was too active, it might attract the attention of the authorities. But Li Tiezhen and the other three leaders had already dedicated their lives to God's work, and they wanted to press forward with no regard for the consequences. There was no way Gao Shengchang could restrain them. For example, when Li Tiezhen wanted to put spring couplets with Christian themes up on the church gate, Gao Shengchang opposed this as being too conspicuous. In China, there are things that you can do, but you cannot be too loud about doing them, he thought. Gao could not change Li's mind, and Li Tiezhen said that they not only had to have a good product, but they also needed some good propaganda, and the spring couplets were an advertisement. What Li Tiezhen said also moved Gao Shengchan. Our mission is just and honorable, and I refuse to hide our light under a bushel. In the end, Li had been right. Many people learned about the church from the spring couplets. They came in to listen to the revival meetings and ultimately joined. Later on, officials from the Bureau of Religion had come to the church and asked them about their activities. But the officials' attitude was not at all antagonistic. They didn't say much, and after they'd gone, nothing more was heard from them. Over the last 2 years, the government had been keeping a very low profile. Gao Shengchan was a graduate of the provincial university. Before going to prison, he'd been a middle school teacher and an avid reader of the reading journal, right up to the moment he came to believe in Jesus Christ.
Себе.